And basically, the information I'm about to give you and your response will not be recorded. My name is Lena Liu, and I'm a student at Duke University. I am in a course on the history of genomics that includes an oral history project. One goal is to produce a written transcript of interviews with important figures in genomics. Some of the interviews may be archived or made public through a website. I selected you as a person I would like to interview. The interview should last about 45 minutes. Your participation in this interview is strictly voluntary, and you may withdraw at any time. You do not have to answer every question asked. The information that you provide will be on the record and may be attributed to you. If you do not want something public, then we will turn the tape off and will ensure that it does not appear in the transcript. This interview is being recorded, and I will take written notes during the interview. The interviews that are posted publicly will be archived as a history resource and may be included as part of the Human Genome Archive established at Georgetown University with funding from the National Science Foundation and now shared between Georgetown and Duke with funding from NIH and the Department of Energy. If you prefer that the interview be used only for the course and not made public, please indicate this. One risk of the study is that you may disclose information that later could be used in ways you do not like and cannot control by those accessing the archives. The benefit of participating in the study is ensuring that your side of the story is properly portrayed in the history of genomics. Dr. Sulston, do you agree to the interview?
That's fine, yes, thank you.
All right. So to start off, could you tell me a little bit about your background and what got you interested in the field of genomics and how you got to where you were today?
It was a natural progression from working with the nematode, C. neuroptysis elegans, in the group here at in the Medical Research Council lab in Cambridge, Laboratory of Molecular Biology. And there we were engaged in a sort of expanding movement, starting with Sydney Brenner's initiative back in the 60s, to develop to study the developmental biology of this little worm. Now, what was happening, and this is true for all experimental animals of this kind, the model organisms, during the 70s, is that the genetic side of things was going very well, but we didn't have the ability to isolate genes quickly, to actually get hold of the gene, clone it, and study it. Sequencing methodology was invented towards the end of the 70s, which was the Sanger method, which allowed one to sequence genes once isolated, but it wasn't practical at that time to sequence the whole genome, so that was out. And I was studying various things. I was studying cell lineage, but anyway, at the beginning of the 80s, it suddenly struck me that we had to do something with the genome as a whole to improve the speed with which one could isolate genes. So I set to, with one colleague and then a growing number, in particular the collaboration with Bob Waterston at St. Louis, Missouri, was absolutely crucial. And in the course of the next few years, we put together a nice map of the genome. Again, no question of sequencing at this stage would have been far too long and costly, but what we could do was to collect clones covering the whole genome and store them in the freezers, and then map them one to another just by using a restriction enzyme procedure. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this is to so you can see how it flowed in a very natural way from the biology to the requirement for a new tool. And it was this initiative and a number of parallel ones, yeast, for example, was early on, and then lots of other organisms gradually started to do it, the idea of laying out the genome, and then, of course, as sequencing methodology caught up or became higher speed, we were all able during the 90s to start sequencing our genomes. So it was an absolutely natural progression. The odd thing for me was getting involved in the human, in a way, because that was accidental. I had no background in human genetics and didn't really expect to be involved, but simply because we were involved, Bob Waterston and I, at the edge of the methodology, we just found ourselves drawn into the sequencing operation, which was known as the Human Genome Project. Just we had the capacity and growing capacity, and also in my case, very crucially, the Wellcome Trust became interested and set up the facilities that we needed for the nematode sequencing, but also, of course, from their point of view, was done in order to sequence the human or part of it. So that was the story, and it really, everything connects together, you know.
Okay, so one of the books we read for our class was The Common Thread that you wrote, And I was really impressed by how firmly you stood against the patenting of the human genome and how you were for how it should be for like the public domain. Why do you believe that the genome should be part of the public domain?
Again, it's pragmatic, and I just take you back once again to the 80s when we were doing this really tiny sort of small community job with the worm. I say small because it's small relative to the human community, and the scientists involved there. We found, Bob Woodston and I, in a very pragmatic way, that it was essential to have free communication at the genomic level. You can call it genomic communication if you like. What it means is that the people doing biology, who are also in an organism like this, obviously geneticists, because that's the game, is discovering mutants, mapping them, and producing a genetic map, which it can then use as a basis for finding important genes important to development. Now, the whole process that I described of mapping the genome only works if people share their information. So once somebody isolates a gene, they have to be willing to put it on the map and say, here is a marker. And this way you align progressively the physical map of the clones in the freezer with the genetic map. And next time somebody coming along looking for a neighboring gene will have a marker to go by, so we know roughly which clones to give them. And that process just goes on getting better and better. If people don't share, then it doesn't work. And I always show a little diagram when I'm giving a talk about this. I show a database which is shut up, so people aren't sharing. Mm-hmm. And the result is that this communication doesn't work. I mean, you can have for example, if you have a private database containing sequence data, or map data, but I mean it's now sequence data, then what happens is that somebody pays to go and look at the data, but they can't share the data with anybody else. Okay, so they can't sort of contribute to each other's operation. And this actually becomes very serious with something like the human genome, where the data set is so vast and so little understood that, you know, the genes are sparse, and we have very much more to discover in terms of control sequences. There's new things coming out all the time, like microRNAs, for example, a whole new category of molecules that people hadn't suspected. It's absolutely impossible to work on these things unless everybody has open, free access to the genome, because that is the map, if you like, as well as the substance that everybody's working on. Does that make sense, or should I expand more?
Could you expand a little bit more, especially about like the mRNA stuff?
About?
Can you expand a little bit more on what you were just talking about?
Okay. Well, imagine that you have we'll shift rather than going back and talking about the mapping, which is historic, let's just talk about sequencing DNA, mm-hmm. sequencing a genome, okay? The human genome sequence is approximately 3 billion bases, all right?
Okay.
Now, if you adopt a privatized model such that the genome is, the information that you get is locked up and is accessible only to paying subscribers. I mean, this is the business model of how to do it, which was, you know, seriously proposed by, and indeed acted upon by Celera and to some degree other corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you do that, then you, in order to have a business model, you need to collect subscriptions from people for access to the data. That is after all the business, and it's fair enough that you get the money for having done the work of sequencing and then letting them look at it. However, what they have to agree to do when they take the look at the data is that they won't share it. Okay? Because
okay.
If they started sharing the data, if they started telling everybody else what the sequence was inside your database, then very soon you wouldn't have a business anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So all the proprietors of this sort of thing have to have very strict rules, you know, legal enforced rules, only subscribers can look at the data, and they may not pass it on. Now, there are various ways in which people, you know, try to get around this and try to make it more flexible, but the truth of the matter is, in the end, that a data set of this kind, a very complex one, which one is going to go on working on for a very long time, because we don't understand it completely, the only way to do it is to have it completely in the public domain. Now, the reason I emphasize for this particular example is that I'm not saying that everything has to be in the public domain. There are particular sorts of information which really should be out in the public. In fact, everybody agrees to this. People in industry agree to this. They say it's really fantastic that we have a public database with the human genome and all these other genomes in. And this really helps our work, and so they call it pre-competitive. They're saying that it's really more efficient if you don't have these things done on a pay-per-view business model, but rather just pay publicly once, get it done properly, and have it open. And so that's what we fought to achieve and did achieve. It applies, I mean, just to illustrate the point, it applies to various other kinds of information. A good example is meteorological information. Very important now is climate change. It's extremely important that people share weather, atmospheric data, and so forth around the world. If you lock it all up into individual databases, which I'm sorry to say the Europeans have a bit of a tendency to do, us Europeans, then it's not so good. The same thing applies to other sorts of biological data. I mean, for example, the structure of the proteins. There's mm-hmm. a big consortium which is discovering protein structures and putting them in the public domain, because again, people can learn a great deal by comparing them, by sharing them. But all of this does not preclude people going off and making inventions or whatever in a proprietary fashion and having businesses based on those. It's just essential data sets should be public.
Okay. Well, during the Human Genome Project, you were basically seen as the figurehead of the British involvement of the Public Sequencing Project. And could you describe your role in the international genetics community, like then and now?
Well, I just would like to slightly modify your statement there. Okay. I mean, although in Britain I was certainly seen that way because I was perforce put into the position of giving interviews and so forth, explaining our work and explaining the importance of the public domain. Of course, in the US, other figures, Francis Collins and Eric Lander and Bob Waterston himself, were all very much the figureheads for the public domain. And so, you know, I don't think I should be seen, I'm not seen as the international figurehead in this regard. Although, of course, I'm not shy about saying what I think. So with that in mind, you know, it should not be seen as a sort of isolated stand on my part. It's a part of it was part of the international consortium.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way I did it. Oh, sorry, can we come back to your question? What exactly did you want me to develop?
I was going to ask if you could describe your role in the international genomics community, like then and now.
Oh, sorry, yes, I see. Well, then what happened is that we were all in it together, and it really was a consortium. We had consortium meetings mm-hmm. In different places, and we, you know, from time to time, every few months, to discuss things, and of course we're in email a great deal. We also had conference calls on the phone every week, and this kept us together and kept the policy moving along, or the technology and the policy, really, of how we would go about things. Now, I, rightly or wrongly, chose to stand down when this was all pretty much in the bag. I stood down from the directorship of the Sanger Institute here, the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, because that was a planned move, really. I've always intended not to go on being a director of a big lab for a long time. It was never my forte and not my choice. What I did do, I actually formally stood down in 2000, which was early on, but I remained the sort of leader of the human side of the Human Sequencing Project, along with extremely able colleagues here, of course. So, I mean, I was very much just a leader. I wasn't doing everything. And what's happened since then, with the publication of the Common Thread, first of all, and then various other events that have led to me being asked to do this and that and the other, I found myself now not doing research science anymore, simply because I find so much of my time is taken up with other things which I think are important, and so I would describe myself as being somebody who's involved in, well, if you like to call it science and society or some phrase of that kind. I'm still very much involved in the importance of openness
mm-hmm.
And the bit of appropriate openness, okay? Not just letting it all hang out, but having good open access to things that matter. I'm interested in the publication, open access publication movement. I'm also interested, and we, in fact, do one thing at a time. My sort of current part-time day job is I'm chair or acting chair of the Human Genetics Commission here in the UK, which is very much involved in this interface between technology and the public. We work for the government, we advise the government by writing reports and responding to specific queries, and we spend a lot of time organizing group meetings and so forth with interested members of the public to talk about human genetics, the developments and so forth, because it's a topic that people are, you know, rightly a little bit wary of. They want to know what's going on, they want to know what it means for them. We also bear in mind, of course, that in the UK, we have the National Health Service, which is what I consider to be a really, really good health provision system. It encompasses everybody, as you probably know. Mm-hmm. Everything is free at the point of delivery. Excuse me. But along with that, it means that, of course, we must take care that the delivery is done properly. And so we have, on the Human Genetics Commission, we have a genetic services subgroup, which constantly sort of monitors what's going on and tries to make sure enough resources are going in and so forth. So you know, it's part of making the British healthcare system work, and it's part of making, or we hope, smoothing the passage of technology into healthcare. Now a new venture, which is not really started yet, but I've accepted the appointment. There's a friend of mine called John Harris, who is a bioethicist, philosopher at Manchester University, and another part-time job I'm now taking is to work with him in a new group called the Institute of Science, Ethics and Innovation, which has just been sort of formally set up. And this is taking a rather broader view, not just bioethics, but in general the way in which science is translated into application, if you like. And I think that, you know, my experiences with the human genome indicate this is actually quite an important thing to take care of, that one really needs to find ways to do things inappropriately. I mean, in the healthcare market, for example, there's an awful lot of stuff being sold inappropriately. You know, drugs being pushed on people who don't need them. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of claims out there for things which are really not appropriate. Things being overprescribed and so forth. And I think that this is something that we need to sort of think about, how we can manage better in society in the future. And it applies right across the board in science. It's not that things are disastrous, but I think that we can do a lot better, and I think we can increase people's faith in science, the ability of science to deliver things which are useful for society. So this sounds probably a little bit vague, because we have quite a long list of potential projects, mm-hmm. and in the next year or two we'll get this going. We have people working there on fellowships who will be looking at very specific topics in this area, producing papers and recommendations, we hope. So these are the sorts of things I'm involved in. As I say, if you want to put an umbrella, it would be science and society.
Okay. Well, that's quite a bit. So going back to the international thing, do you think that during the Human Genome Project there could have been more international involvement as a whole? Or do you think that that would have led to an increased amount of competition overall?
No, I think it would have been very good if more countries had been more involved. As it was, we had a pretty good spread. But mm-hmm. it's true that there's a large fraction of the work was ended up being done in the US because of the NIH and DOE involvement and commitment, and in the UK, number two, because of the Wellcome Trust involvement. The UK government did not put a great deal of money in. The French government put a small amount in, one chromosome's worth, the Germans a little bit, Japan and later on China all put in substantial amounts. Not sure if that list is complete, but anyway, we did have a round the world sort of activity. But it would have been great if it had worked out to be more evenly distributed. It's true, we got what was possible from what people were willing to fund.
Okay, so in your opinion, given that America is naturally a competitive country when it comes to industry, were the differences between England and the U.S. enough that it caused considerable tension between the two when it came to the sequencing of the human genome?
No, because we're in the public domain, and that isn't different. I mean, sure, America is good at competition, but then the Brits here compete as well. So are you thinking of the sort of industrial pressures? Or?
Yes, like the industrial pressures, as well as like kind of in the inventive pressures, like with the patenting thing.
I would say back to patent. Yes, well, I mean, right in the early days, of course, at NIH, there was an internal discussion about whether or not sequence fragments ought to be patented. And with the change of head to Harold Varmus, that discussion changed a great deal. It was Harold, I think, who knocked the idea of filing sequence fragments anymore, but that was certainly being tried under the previous NIH head. So he made a great difference there. Jim Watson was always very much against gene patenting, and of course was asked to. Well, sort of mainly that was the reason why he had to step down from being head of the Human Genome Project in the early 90s. I mean, the idea of patenting DNA sequences is very much an extension, in my view, of what I was saying about databases, but perhaps with a slightly different slant on it. Again, you see, if you take a gene, let's consider a whole gene for the sake of argument rather than just a fragment,
mm-hmm.
and you suppose you have a gene sequence. If you have a full exclusive rights type of patent on it, then what it means is that you can stop anybody else working on it, at least, you know, in commercial terms, and to some extent even in research labs, depending exactly what the what the conditions of access are for non-profits. That's one of the things that sort of rather varies in patent law around the world, and people are always trying to be clear about what you can and can't do in a not-for-profit research lab when something has a patent on. But just think about commercially for a moment, because of course many academic labs as well as university labs potentially are going to produce something for profit. I mean, they're expected to have that potential at least, and so restrictions of this kind affect everybody. So I think we can say very, very roughly that if somebody has an exclusive rights patent on a full-length DNA sequence, then it stops other people doing much at all. And we see examples of this in the case of Myriad with BRCA1 and 2 was an early case where they got the full portfolio on those genes initially. And I think they still hold those portfolios in the US.
Mm.
The portfolios have been very largely revoked by the European Patent Office, which I think is a good thing, although not for the reason that the European Patent Office doesn't think people ought to patent genes, but because they didn't file the right sequence.
Oh.
So that was that knocked them on the head. So, I mean, they're left with just one or two very specific patents, and there's a whole interesting story about that, which I'm sure you're aware of, and I won't go into that anymore just now, but what's happened, I think, is that things have now moved on to some extent, and the demand for very clear utility has sort of raised the bar a bit, I think, to people getting patents. So it's no longer good enough just to produce a bit of DNA sequence and say, look, I want a patent on this, which, in the beginning, people thought was fine. But now you have to say exactly what you're going to do with it. Now, just coming back, though, to the principle of the thing, it seems to me if you do allow patents on naked DNA sequence, if you do lock them up in this way, then actually it's very much opposed to both good research practice and to good business practice, because it's essentially a very anti-competitive move. It's like patenting, in the famous analogy that we always use about the mouse traps, it's like patenting the idea of a mouse trap, so nobody else can even try to make a mouse trap, as opposed to patenting a particular design of mouse trap, which then encourages other people to invent around you and produce a better design. So it is with a human gene. A human gene cannot be invented around. Okay? Given gene to a given locus, that is the gene. And if somebody really owns it in the commercial sense of the patent, then it means for the duration of the patent, and that may be quite long given evergreening and so forth, the other people are inhibited from competition. I think that is actually very poor business practice. It's something that really the Supreme Court is beginning to recognize, I think, that this kind of extreme patenting is not very productive, and I think that bit by bit people are edging towards a more rational position. If you want to have patents on things like that, then in my opinion they ought to be not exclusive rights patents but remuneration patents. I think there is a case that if you've gone to a lot of trouble to identify a gene and isolate it, if it was non-obvious to do so, which may be the case early in the field, or a gene which is particularly obscure, then it's not unreasonable, perhaps, that you would have some kind of rights over it, although personally as a public servant I wouldn't want to do that, but I can see that it's reasonable to have that. But they should not block other people from doing things. And I think if the international patent community generally were to move towards remuneration patents, then I think that would be a marvellous thing, because what that means is that nobody is inhibited from working a particular discovery, but they are then required perhaps to pay a certain fee to the originators, but they can't be blocked and they can't be asked for unreasonable fees of the sort that Myriad have been charging for the BRCA genes. That's my opinion.
Okay, so do you think, okay, so given that, I'm going to name a company here, like Celera, since that was the main proponent for patenting with Craig Venter, do you think that a true collaboration between the public Human Genome Project and Celera could have happened?
We tried. I mean, there was a meeting at the very end of the millennium, curiously enough, the very last days of 1999. There was a meeting between representatives of the public project and representatives of Celera with a view to trying to defuse the situation, which had got fairly aggravated in the press. Mm-hmm. And it is all hinged on whether or not Celera is willing to release the data. And the financial head, Tony White of Celera, turned up on the Celera side and said there's no way that data is going to be released. I can't remember, it's in the Commons thread, the time, I think he quoted 10 years if I remember rightly, but that's not on the record in the sense that I can't remember the exact figure. Anyway, he was going to have quite a long delay before anything could be released. This made it impossible, released freely I mean, this made it impossible then for us to follow the model which I was explaining earlier in connection with the ring fence database. Mm-hmm. It followed the model of open release to our clients, who are the world scientists at large. So we were not able to have agreement. It wasn't to do with patents particularly. It had to do with open release.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, you. The thing is, when you ask about Craig Venter, this is very tricky because he now says in his book, I don't know if you looked at this, that he never wanted patents, he never went for patents, and that it was a misrepresentation to suggest that he did. Unfortunately, that's not the case. I mean, the record showed very clearly that he was going after patents. However, he says that was something he was forced to do and he didn't want to. So it's very difficult to know exactly what Venter himself wanted, because different bits of his record say different things. So I wouldn't want to sort of cite any particular view with respect to him. That's why I mentioned Tony White, who definitely had a particular view about how Celera's information was to be used.
Okay, so given that it takes a lot of money to do genomics, and given that Celera was a private company and was basically the main challenger to the public sequencing effort, do you believe that the governments of the Human Genome Project provide enough incentive to sequence the genome quickly and accurately?
But the government?
Yeah.
Did?
The governments involved in the Human Genome Project, as in like the US, the UK, and so forth.
I'm not quite sure what the question is, to be honest. Can you rephrase it a little, just to get me... I'm not quite sure what you're asking, sorry.
Okay, so given that Celera had a lot of money and was able to, get a faster sequencing thing, do you think that the government should have, provided more incentive
By more incentive, do you mean more resources or
anything?
Or different policy rules or?
It could be anything. Like, in general, what do you think?
What do I think?
Yes.
Well, the thing is, I don't accept, I'm afraid, that Solera had such a quicker, faster method, certainly not at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's true that, of course, it has been, you know, people have moved on very usefully to more and more sort of shotgunning of genomes as the machines have improved, but the cost had very little to do with the technique, the approach. It had much more to do just with the gradually developing technology of the machines. And the figures that were quoted by Solera about the rate of progress and the costs of the public domain operation are wrong. The press releases invariably indicated that the public was very slow and expensive, and it simply wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
The public domain was actually very competitive. So I don't think that there was anything lacking there. I mean, obviously, the more resource you have, the faster you can go. And as you know, there was the element of a race, because if Solera had managed to get really a lot of patents filed and accepted on the genome, then that would have been very bad for everybody. So we were anxious to make sure that we had enough data out there at all times to prevent that happening, which we did. That's why I was a little puzzled about your question. I'm not quite sure, you know, what the... it seems like I'm not accepting the principle that you're asking about. You
know. No, I think you answered it pretty
well.
Yeah, that was what I wanted to know.
Okay.
Also, like, you mentioned the press's role in the Human Genome Project and how they kind of got the information wrong. What's your opinion of the press's role and actions during the Human Genome Project?
Whose role?
The press, you know, like the news and what so forth.
Oh, the media?
Yeah, the media.
Sorry. Their role, well, it's very interesting. Let me illustrate. I had a conversation at some point after all this, you know, 2002 or something, when I was doing quite a lot of interviewing, with somebody rang up from Romania, from the press there, and we started to talk about this, about the role of the media, and I think at that time I was a bit critical because I felt fairly bruised by some of the things that had gone on, the misrepresentations that you know, journalists would then pick up on and turn into headlines and things like this, and I was pretty sort of antsy about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to me the remaining thing, she said, well, just think, you know, how would you like it if there was only one media and it was state controlled?
Oh.
And I thought, yeah, you're right. I said to her straight away, I said, gosh, yes, I really see what you're saying. And I kind of knew this inside me, but it just focused me about the necessity of having a free media.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you have a free media, then of course the only way we know to make it free, messy as it is that it's competitive. And, you know, you have a lot of different people racing around for stories. Some care more about the story, some care more about the headline, some care very much about having their stuff absolutely accurate, and that, you know, they tend to write for different sorts of papers or broadcast on different TV channels and so on. And you get to know, you know, the people that you want to read because you trust them more than the others, perhaps. But the essential messiness of it, and the fact that there is going to be a feeding frenzy when some interesting conflict is going on, I think is probably an inescapable part of our free media. And so, you know, having sort of done on a few years of it and mellowed a bit, I sort of see this, although I was angry at the time, I now see that this is absolutely essential. And I'm also, it's really opened my eyes to the world that, you know, politicians have to live in, you know, where there are people running around trying to get mucky stories about them all the time because they will sell their newspaper. But on the other hand, they're also using the media to communicate with the public, and it's sort of inescapable, this messiness, I think, of the whole thing. If we ever manage to have a media which is both open and always fair and always accurate, then that will be a wonderful thing, but I'm not sure that the last two are compatible with the openness.
Okay. Well, one of the big, huge things that the media jumped on recently was the thing with Jim Watson.
Ah, yes.
His statement, yes, that.
Yes, absolutely tragic. And I think that is it's a very negative thing to on the part of the British media. I've been away actually for 3 weeks, and this largely happened while I was away. Mm-hmm. And as I understand, I mean, he gave an interview. The thing is, Jim has always said things like this. And I don't think what he said on this particular occasion was any more outrageous than things he's said before.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly has been sailing very near the wind in his remarks about genetics and mental capability and genetic behaviour. And, you know, we've all been sort of thinking, oh, maybe it's better not to quite express things in this way. On the other hand, you know, at some point we are going to have to address these, but we do have to make sure we address them carefully. And what little I've seen of the transcripts of his conversation, I mean, he was making this very unwise connection between IQ tests and a particular racial grouping. So that's, you know, it's been a very, very emotive thing for decades now. And I simply wouldn't go there. But I would not go there personally, because I don't think we know enough yet, and we don't understand what the social factors are involving score and IQ tests, for example. We don't understand that. We don't understand cultural background to them at all. All we can see is that, you know, when you take a homogeneous group, then things are fairly consistent. But if you're taking two different groupings, then it's not clear. Not clear, you know, what the connection is between IQ and doing things like running countries. And so I really think he was really allowing himself to go off base.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, he was discussing a subject which is important, and I think the media jumping on him this way and creating this food fight was dreadful, and the fact he's had to step down I think is a real, real shame.
Yeah.
You know, it's coming back to, I mean, you know, he's a politician in the sense, I mean, you know, in science, you know, he's a very high-profile ambassador, and therefore he has had to accept the results in the same way as politicians do when they somehow get out of, stray off safe quotes. So I'm very sad that,
yeah,
see how it came about. And I certainly don't condone the journalists who chose to blow it up into this big story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Craig Venter has just recently published his genome. And what do you think of this? And would you have your own genome published, and why?
Craig can do whatever he likes. That's fine. It's free world. I don't see any, in fact there is no great value in publishing a single genome. All that we know about genomes comes out of comparative studies, and the reason he's able to make remarks, to make statements about particular genetic variants he carries is not because his genome's published, but because there's a lot of work already been done on those genes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that sense, what's new? It's true that now, what he and others say they're going to do, I mean, it's true, there's interest here at the Sanger Institute in going on and sequencing many individuals and comparing them, that, of course, will be valuable. But it's having large cohorts of genomes, not having a single one, which is going to advance our knowledge. Would I have mine done? No. I certainly wouldn't want at this point to have that sort of money spent on my genome. I think that would not be sensible, not a good use of money. I mean, to be a volunteer, to be one of the many who are being sequenced, sure, that's no problem. I don't mind being sequenced, but I wouldn't want to put myself forward in that fashion. There is an issue which I hope we'll get over with all this, and I agree with Craig when he says that it's good if we develop more openness. I'm very sensitive to the people's feelings about this because of my work with the Human Genetics Commission, and there are some people who feel very much that we should keep all this stuff under lock and key. And so one of the things I'm working for very much with the Human Genetics Commission, and I'm following avidly the work that's being done on GINA in the US, you know, the bill that's in the Senate now.
Yeah.
I think it's extremely important that we develop statutes that prevent genetic discrimination mm-hmm. against individuals. I think if we can do that, then we have gone a very long way to defusing any worries we might have about having a lot of human sequence variants, you know, people's knowledge about human sequence variants floating around. However, we do have to, I think, for most people, have a degree of respect. I mean, within families, for example, one thing that the current generation is going to have to come to terms with is that everybody will know who their father is, mm-hmm. and this is quite new. You know, people have been able to get away with fathering children and escaping the consequences in the past, and that will no longer be the case, clearly. But also, more subtly, you know, people's concerns about genetic problems, genetic diseases, or genetically influenced diseases. You know, people are very sensitive about this sort of thing in the family. They've been traditionally been quite reticent. It's something that people may have to come to terms with more, the fact that families do share their genetics, and if you have anything unusual, perhaps damaging in your family, then we shall know more and more about it. But I think this, so long as we respect people, you obviously must respect people's dignity and not just spray genomes around without their permission. Mm-hmm. But I think we should get used to the fact that this is something which we do know all about, and obviously more and more human genomes, probably all human genomes within 50 years or less, will be sequenced, just as a matter of course in medical practice. And then we shall, you know, we shouldn't have to be too sensitive about this data. just keep it reasonably private, as we do with other medical information.
Okay, so where do you think the future of science is headed right now?
Science?
Yes, science in general.
That's a big question.
Do you want to focus it down to just like genetics then?
Well, no, not particularly. I think it's a good question. I mean, I think, well, the answer to that is I hope it's going somewhere that none of us have thought of yet, because that's the fun part of science, is that new things happen. And when so if you focus it down and you say, well, where's genetics headed? Well, I sort of indicated a bit about genetics. I think we're just going to have more and more information. I think that the understanding, which is to me the interesting part and important part, is going to take rather longer. I mean, I suppose as far as this whole business of genetics and genomics is concerned, is what I want to see, and this is happening actually to a considerable extent, is that it just gets incorporated back into biology. We've been through this sort of wave of excitement about genomics, and I told you my personal history, and I think you'd already looked at it in the book, you know, about how I just got into mapping because we needed those tools, and then I got into sequencing because that was a tool, and so forth. Now we've done that, you know, we've done quite a lot of that. There's a lot of this routine resequencing to be done, but the very important thing now is to use all this information and just incorporate it into biology, which again, of course, brings us back to the reason of why it's so important for it to be open, you know, that you can browse the genomes, and not only the human genome, but all the genomes anywhere. You can just go in through the web. You don't have to pay, you don't have to click, you don't have to do anything. You just do your work with these things, and they become part and parcel of the tools on every biologist's bench. So that, as far as I'm concerned, is the important message with genetics and genomics. You know, so this is not special. This is just another whole chunk of information we know about, the whole set of new tools to use. Where is biology going? Well, obviously, to the extent that we understand, we can also manipulate and modify. Genetic engineering obviously is going ahead. There's this great excitement talking about synthetic biology, the idea of synthesizing entire genomes. That's all very fine, but the important thing is to understand what you're doing. And I think that we have a lot to learn before we can start putting together really useful functional things, although obviously one can do sort of demonstration projects of producing new genomes, which aren't very different from the ones we've got. But to start doing really different things, we have to really understand the genes, and certainly in that sense, synthetic biology has a very exciting future. But the thing is, the future has to be thought of in terms of systems biology, because we know very well that the genes are highly interactive one with another. You've got all the parts. pathways set up and genes operating in more than one place, and until we understand a great deal more about the control of genes and how they interact, which will come progressively, you know, through looking at subsystems, but until we can do that, then you know, we probably there won't be such good possibilities of producing really novel life forms. But I think definitely that's on the cards for the future, and it's something that of course we need to constantly you know, have some sort of ethical looking at. And I think I hope that by involving the public at all stages of this, that people will go along with it together, you know, rather than there being crises and worries about mad scientists and so forth, which is always, you know, it's always a problem with us. But well, yeah, it's being talked about a lot. I'm very pleased with the way communication is opening up more and more, you know, people writing and interviewing. I like particularly to see developments like the Café Scientifique and so on, you know, the kind of ways of especially bringing younger scientists into contact, talking about their work. I think the more of this we can do, the better, and this will mean that we have a very, you know, exciting and not bumpy journey ahead of us.
Okay. Well, if you could, like, send a message to the future, like, 100 years from now, what would be in that message and why? So, sorry, it's an odd question, but I just want to know.
Yes. Sending a message to the future. I think my message would be stay alive. Because the thing that is... well, first, it should be in two parts. First part of the message would say, I hope you have stayed alive. And the second would be, hang in there. Now, the reason I say that is because... you know, we do have certain threats which are due to ourselves. In fact, most of the threats boil down in the end to overpopulation. It really is back to that. You know, the climate change is down to that. The worrying about food supplies and so forth due to that. And of course, also the possibility of having fun. You know, that the travelling, for example, which is such a marvelous part of life, is something that it's hard to imagine everybody in the world, 9 billion people as they will be in 2050, having the same sort of travelling privileges that we have in the most developed countries now. I mean, we just aren't going to have, in any kind of current technology, the fuel or the space, you know, to do the travelling. I mean, we can only support this large world population by lots of people being basically nailed to their patch in considerable poverty, and that seems to me to be dreadful. So I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, you don't sort of pick out any particular thing. I do think, though, that it's tremendously important and fun for humanity to keep pegging along. Mm-hmm. And to stay alive. I mean, when I say pegging along, that's tongue-in-cheek. I mean, you know, gloriously, gloriously into the future. And I think of this very much in terms of science, but I think of it in terms of the exploration. You know, I mean, science is such a wonderful exploration, and we have such infinite potential, literally infinite in terms of the universe potential. We have a vast amount of time, but we have got to be sensible about it. We've got to deal with these little crises as they come along, like climate change, like overpopulation, food supplies, without having the final, you know, World War III self-annihilation, which is a real possibility. We still have enough nuclear weapons hanging around the various countries to kill everybody quite quickly. Mm-hmm. We still have the possibilities of biowarfare, all the things that people worry about. And so that's why my message to the future would be that I hope you're still alive. And I should underline this by saying, I mean, I'm afraid I'm not a believer. I think that we are what we are, and we've got what we've got. I'm perfectly happy for other people to have, beliefs. I don't get into fights about it, but what I would always remind them is that we do not know that we have anything more than ourselves and the world, and it's conceivable, despite, you know, all the science fiction, that we are the only intelligent life form in the universe. And if that's true, then it would be absolutely dreadful if we were to snuff ourselves out through greed and fighting. So you can see why I'm interested in sort of the science and society, to try and, you know, contribute a little bit in my remaining years to finding out the reasons for things going wrong to see if we can do more about making them go good. And that means for 9 billion people, it's a tall order for everybody. I don't know, you know, if I can contribute anything, but you know, none of us know that. You have to look into things that you think are important and try to pursue them. So that's what I'm doing now, and that will be my message. I do hope everybody's still around 100 years. You may well be.
Hopefully.
Right?
Yeah, hopefully.
Because, I mean, the age is going up. So, I don't know. You're being a reporter in this interview, so I'm not supposed to ask your views. But if we're getting towards the end, can I ask your views? Do you agree with me on what I've just said, just off the record, as it were?
Yes, I agree very much with you.
Good.
Yeah.
That's all we need. Yeah. If we have enough agreement on this point, then we shall survive.
I hope so. I truly hope so.
Yeah.
One last question. Is there anything that you wish you could have done, like, in the past, or do you have no regrets?
Oh, you know, que sera, sera. I mean, I think there are always infinite things, you know, and I certainly, I can look back and I think, well, I really would have preferred not to have done that, or it would have been nice to have followed the other. But I've had a fantastic, privileged life. I really have enjoyed the progress so much. I mean, I've had huge moments of despair. In fact, I'm one of those people, kind of depressive types, who actually get most down when they're in despair.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's when you really feel you're at the bottom, the lower limit, you know, and everything's gone wrong, you know, not just that day, but that month and that year, you know, everything is awful. And the thing is, at that point, you don't care anymore, and you just sort of bury yourself into doing something, and quite often in that situation, you do something new, and that's how it's been for me. So that's, you know, it's not that it's all an even keel, but then overall, you know, just hugely exciting and privileged to have had a ringside seat at all the things that have, you know, I've been involved in. But then, of course, you could say, of course, it would have been fun to do something else, but nobody can do everything.
All right, so the interview's almost over, but I lied about that being the last question. Is there anything that you think I should have asked?
I mean, we could talk, obviously, for months.
Well,
and that would be fun. But no, I mean, it's fine. I think you've asked some good questions, and I hope I've given you satisfactory answers. Satisfactory in the sense that comprehensible.
No, they were very clear.
And you obviously, I mean, I'm not your only interviewee, right? You're putting together a whole sort of set of things,
mm-hmm.
presumably. So it's the tapestry that counts. And I wish you well in putting your thesis together.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Have fun.
All right.
All the best.
By the way, I will be sending a transcript of this interview to you. So
okay.
That you can make any corrections or anything that you need. If you see that there's something wrong or if I have questions,
All right. Yes, okay. I mean, I hope you'll... I'm quite slow and repetitive in speech, I know. So you'll feel free, I hope, to adjust the transcript to take up those the bits of nonsense. I mean, you know what I mean. I mean,
yeah.
If you really write out literally what I said, it's all a lot of ers and ums and things said twice. So anyway, whatever you do, maybe what do? You just type it out, do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, as I say, feel free to sort of save some of the hiccups if you want. But if not, if you'd rather not do it that way, then of course do it hiccups and all. Whatever.
Okay.
Okay. Hope it doesn't take too long. I probably said too much.
No. You said what, like, really good stuff, and I walked out. I'm going to walk out of this interview, like, knowing, like, so much more, and being like, I'll be a better person because of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's very kind, and I enjoyed talking. So
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
And you.
Bye.
Bye.